Colonel Collins, Real 2. We were talking about your activities with the Exeter University OTC between roughly 1940-1942. One thing you mentioned was you said you didn't do actual firing, but that you did some weapon familiarisation. What level did that go to? Were you stripping guns, or were you just shown them?
Well, funny enough, I can't remember stripping guns, although if we I can't distinctly remember, or do I? I can't be sure. I think we must have done. I don't know why I think that, because when I was then later conscripted into the army and became a recruit, I found that I was several jumps ahead of everybody else in the squad, so I must have done quite a lot of that stuff.
Which weapons had you seen? Was it the...
The number 4 Lee Enfield rifle.
Did you have them for drill purposes? I mean, did you use them while you were doing your foot drill?
Well, again, I can't remember distinctly that, but I think if we did any weapon handling at all, we would have handled them on the parade ground as well. And learned to clean them, you know, and learned how to take up a firing position and that sort of thing.
Now, what about this field craft, elementary field craft? Well, what sort of things were you doing?
Well, you see, the training pamphlet teaches you how to crawl, and how to stay low, and how to take up an inconspicuous firing position.
What sort of things would they mean? I mean, how to crawl? What was different from any other sort of crawl?
I mean, you've got to be tall. You know, the old thing was, there are two types of foot soldiers or infantrymen in battle: the quick and the dead. You see, and you have to cultivate art of just sensing where a danger might be, and sense that you're in a possible line of fire, and you get down absolutely as low as you can, and crawl with your elbows spread and your knees spread as much as you can, and make the best speed you can while keeping as close to the part of anything else you might not be seeing then, you see, that's just the hope.
And they taught you that, started to learn that at the OTC level?
I think I must have done. We certainly, we must have done, but only just in the sort of college precincts, you know, just around the, we used to parade outside the Washington Singer Laboratory, which still stands there, and of course now it's one of the principal, at that time it was the only building on where the Exeter University site now, where that was, that and the library, and Marvin Hall still exists, but, the Washington Singer Laboratory. Now there's a whole university campus there.
You learned how to crawl. Did you do any actual exercises, you know, pretending to attack a position?
I remember doing that. I tell you one thing in particular I remember. I remember because in the training manual there's a thing about the characteristics of a good fire position, a good firing position. You see, there's certain things that you have to be particular about when you're choosing a firing position. I remember learning this. And it goes with a little, what do you call the thing? And it's not an acronym. It's an acronym. Anyway, BRIEF, brief. And I remember learning this, it must be bulletproof, room for free use of the weapon, inconspicuous, easy to move from, and have a good field of fire, you see. Now, I remember that. And I learned that there. And when I joined the army and became a recruit, I always remember that... That was one of the things that they tried to teach us. And even the corporal teaching us couldn't remember it. And he always used to ask me what it was. And I learned it there, you see. So I do remember we did that sort of. And I don't think we would have learned it in a classroom. I mean, there would be no point in that. We must have done it on a bit of ground.
So what you found, essentially, some of this... Simple tactical field stuff, quite useful then. It wasn't unrealistic, the things they were telling you.
By no means, no. It was very, very relevant. And when one became a recruit, hence I succeeded, you know, notably as a recruit, which that had given me a head start.
Now, anything else you did with the OTC? Any other training?
I don't think so.
Did you get any promotion in the OTC?
No, I don't think we didn't. I don't remember having any junior, you know, any cadet ranks or whatever. If there were, I didn't have one.
So this Sergeant Major Shoulder, I think you mentioned, was he an old regular then?
Yes.
Did he have any?
Well, he was a current regular. You know, it was his his assignment.
Had he served in the First War?
I don't know.
Did he give any practical advice? I mean, was he? Did you look up to him as a practical serving soldier? Or?
Not really, no. I didn't think of him in those terms anyway. I mean, he was very good and he knew the form and he jollied us along, you know. And I don't remember him telling any personal anecdotes or anything like that.
Now, you were in the officers' training corps. Did you actually see it? Did you actually see yourself as going into the army after this?
Not really. At least I don't remember really thinking actively about it a great deal. I suppose I must have begun to think about it.
But from the sound of it, it was basically you had to be in it, so you were in it and took it in good part.
I took it in good part, and that's right.
Now, the other thing you mentioned was that you were doing fire watching. Was that as part of the OTC, or was this as part of the Air Raid Precautions Unit?
Part of the Air Raid Precautions Unit, entirely separate.
How had you been recruited to that?
Well, you know, again, I can't remember, but I mean, everybody had to take, in our own building, everybody had to take turns, as I recall. Whenever the Air Raid siren went, somebody would have been, there would have been a rota for certain. And actually, and all the halls of residence, you know, had to post fire watchers. And then certain buildings, you had people on duty the whole time, whether there was an air raid warning or not.
What type of building?
Every night. The Washington Singing Laboratory, for example. That was one of the standing things. And the beauty of this was we got paid for doing that. And of course, money was extremely scarce. One had no money. I had no money.
That was only when you were on these permanent buildings, or would you get paid for overnight in the Hall of Residence?
I don't think we got paid for overnight in the Hall of Residence. You know, that was part of that. I mean, my duty station, when the alarm went off, I was one of those designated to go and look after the girls. Well, there were two women's halls near us. Near Kilmore, it was Hope Hall and Lopez. Don't ask me who Lopez was now, but still. And I and one or two others, you know, we went off at the double. It was thought the girls couldn't look after themselves for some reason. They wouldn't like that now, would they? Because especially, just digressing a moment, of course, one of the other, all the principal buildings in the city had fire watches, notably the cathedral. And my wife, Mary, I mentioned she was a student, and she used to fire watch on the cathedral, on Exeter Cathedral. And one would be up on the roof there all night, you know, and with buckets of sand and buckets of water and spirit pumps.
So, now you would be sent to the women's hall, you'd rush there. Would you have any uniform of any sort?
I'd have my gas mask and my steel helmet. I remember on one occasion, stupidly, the incendiary bombs had started to fall, you know, when I was on my way there, and my steel helmet had this sort of regulation camouflage net on it. Which, of course, wasn't in itself camouflage, but that was meant to hold camouflage. And I remember on my way, it was only about a quarter of a mile, and the incendiary bombs were falling, and one fell quite near me as I was going by. And I stupidly whipped off my helmet to try and sort of beat the flames out, when, of course, it was hopeless to do that. All it did was to set the camouflage in the fire. So I would go up there.
Now, so would you take any equipment with you, or you just run yourself?
Well, just run myself. As I say, my gas mask and steel helmet, as I remember.
And which hall were you on? Hope Hall. And you'd go onto the roof, I presume.
I suppose, I can't remember, I have to say, I can't remember exactly where our post was. We were there, I mean, had the building caught fire, we were the first line of defence.
How many would there be on Lopez?
Well, perhaps only three or four of us. I mean, it's only for the initial action. I mean, then everybody else is all hands to the pump. Right?
And what at the post, what would you have to fight fires?
You had buckets of sand and stirrup pumps. Yeah, if you know what I mean by a stirrup pump, it's a pump that's, you have a bucket of water and the thing is like, it just stands. One thing to be secure it with the foot outside the bucket and the pump itself is in the bucket of water. And then you stand erect and pump vertically. And there's a pipe leading off, just giving you a hose of water.
Did you have to actually ever deal with fires or incendiaries?
Oh, okay, no.
Where did you?
Well, I don't remember, in fact, fighting fires particularly. What I do remember is helping to dig people out of bombed buildings. That was a very searing experience.
What do you recall of that? Do you know the date? Was it one of the big ones?
I can't. Well, I don't think it could have been the biggest one, because I was referring to that date recently. It was a date in August 42, and I had left Exeter and I joined the army by then. Subsequent to the 20th of August, which incidentally is 51 years ago today since I joined the army, and I was reading in this historical survey, which they had recently, a date for one of the main attacks, which was subsequent to that date, so I couldn't have been there then. But, I mean, there were a number of attacks on Exeter.
And what do you remember, then, of this digging? How did you get to be involved?
Well, I'll tell you three particular things. Well, I mean, we were young men, you know, and when the bombs fell, immediately after, as far as I can recall, we just went out straight away to see where we could help and what, you know, where the wardens were and what we could do. And I remember going not far down the road from Exeter Hall to some houses there when there was one that had received a direct hit. And, you know, there had been known to be people inside there. And then we tried to buy manually just to pull away the rubble and this sort of thing. And, you know, we eventually found other people gathered, and we eventually found the people under the stairs. Unfortunately, the stairs had collapsed, and so they were dead. They were crushed. It was quite a searing thing. And I just mentioned two or three things. I remember that distinct. I remember being in Sidwell Street, Exeter, which was ablaze from one end to the other. And we were trying to help a gang of us, the students. You know, the students turned out and rallied and helped. That's what it boiled down to, really. Helping the firefighting people. Of course, the fire engines couldn't be everywhere. So I remember that one night in Sidwell Street. I remember the pubs were open.
What could you do? I mean, the street was ablaze end to end. I mean, what would you do?
You know, that's an extraordinary thing. A sort of detail. I mean, I just can't remember. But I mean, one must have tried to get water and, you know, and tackle flames where we could. There isn't much one can do, really, what it comes to, unless you've got proper equipment. We didn't have proper equipment. You know, it is, one feels compelled to try and help. So, I mean, but I do have that memory of one particular thing we could do and did do, and that was many houses which weren't themselves directly hit had all the tiles displaced from the roof, so they exposed the weather. And I spent many hours, when I might have been studying, up on people's roofs replacing the tiles, just on a common sense basis, you know, just helping them out. And, you know, one spent a lot of time doing that. You know, less work than I might have done.
Would you ever go to the shelters, or would you always be out in the raid doing fire?
I can't remember where there were any shelters in Exeter. I can't remember that, funnily enough. My wife remembers clearly at her home. She lived in Greater London, and I remember being in the shelter there. And I remember having a shelter here. We had a shelter, which is now on the back terrace there. We had it in here and in the dining room. And when the alarm went here, then the family went under this shelter here. But funnily enough, at Kilmore, when those alarms went off, I mean, I was on duty either, as a warden. You know, I saw myself, as most of the students, as being on duty. I went to try and do something. So I don't remember.
Did you have any bombs? Well, the incendiary bombs you mentioned landed close to you. Did you have any actual close escapes?
No. I mean, that was as close as maybe just falling on you, but it wouldn't have done any good. But, I had no.
Now, as your second year went on, you were studying, you had this problem with physics, you mentioned. Were you anticipating being called up, or did you think of volunteering, or what were your plans at this stage?
Well, I was rather vague and naive about it, quite honestly. and I just sort of went on. My next objective was to try and prepare for that exam again in 1942, for the exam in 1942. And I can't remember. Well, I do remember many people who had a scientific training. They went into the Ministry of Supply, as it then was, to help in the war effort in some way. And they were trying to recruit people, chemists and physicists. One of my close chums, a chap called Norman Ryder, he was a physicist and a good one, and he went to work on radar. And he subsequently became the director of the meteorological office, by the way. I think I got that right. I think he was the director of the meteorological office. Certainly he was very high up in that world, and it came from his early work in radar. Another chap called Bob Wilkins was a chemist, and he went off and worked in some chemistry. I don't remember him being there. I remember him very clearly being in the cadet corps. And incidentally, it just comes to my mind, I can envisage him in a group photograph that we had at that OTC. He went off to be a chemist somewhere, and he rose to great heights and became chairman and managing director of the Beechwood Group eventually. But still, I didn't aspire quite honestly. I thought it was the natural, logical thing to do. And I was sent up to London to do some sort of a test. And obviously I wasn't good enough. For very obvious reasons. I was not as advanced in science as I should have been, or might have been. And I was just 19. As a matter of fact, my call-up was deferred, believe it or not, so that I could finish taking that exam. So then when I didn't complete the exam and didn't qualify to go into the Ministry of Supply, I was conscripted. I simply got my conscription papers.
And how did you feel about that?
I don't remember now feeling any great sense of elation or any great sense of grievance or anything in particular. I just took it.
And that was on, you were called up on the 20th of August 1942. And by then you'd be back in Bodmin, would you?
I must have been back here, yes. I suppose, although I got a little holiday job somewhere. I did stay on at Exeter and help with fruit picking or something like that. So I may have been, I know my parents were a bit dismayed that I didn't want to come home immediately the vacation started, which they thought was the natural thing to do. But anyway, I eventually was here in time to go and report.
Now, what do you remember about going into report 51 years ago today?
Well, I just remember walking up to the barracks, which is about a mile from here.
Now, that's the Duke of Cornwall's Light Infantry Barracks.
That's right.
In Bodmin.
Now at that time it was number 32 County Primary Training Centre, CPTC. It was known as 32 CPTC. The old barracks stood there inside the wall. There's a wall surround, and that walled area very literally belongs to the army still. In fact, just what's known as the keep at the entrance. Of course, I remember going in there, and I was just going to say that there was that older part of the barracks, which was pre-World War One, I'm sure. I don't know the precise date of it, but in the 1930s, there had been built a new barracks up on the hill beyond, which is now an industrial estate, and a lot of the buildings up there survive now, and for example, the town swimming pool, which is up there, was a gymnasium at that time, and that was the county primary training centre. It was largely housed in that extension, that extended barracks at the back.
Now, what was your reception? You were going in as a conscript private soldier.
Yes, private.
Were you actually joining the DCLI, or were you just? It was just a depot.
It was just a primary training centre. I went in, I think that about, in my intake, there was something like 300 people. We comprised, well, in the company that I was in, I'm not sure how many came in this time. Whether other companies were recruited on that day or whether they were a day or two later, but certainly the day that I went in, one was given a uniform and boots and that sort of thing, and assigned to a barrack room.
Now, did you, just to touch on the uniform, that you're a fairly small stature, did they have any trouble with the uniform, or?
I don't remember that being so. I mean, they had a whole range of sizes. I mean, I was not exceptionally small in those days, I think, for run-of-the-mill chaps from, well, I say, my sort of background, you know, it was not altogether uncommon.
So they gave you a uniform and then put you in a company. Did it have a name, the company?
Well, I seem to remember it was given a letter. It was a letter name. I think it may have been D Company, but I'm not absolutely sure. It didn't have a name, but it was just a company. It was a training company, and it was about 300 strong. It didn't bear any relation to a battle company.
What were your first impressions of your fellow recruits? Were they generally from the same sort of background?
Well, I knew one of them. He was a chap who had been at Exeter with me. I don't really know how to answer that. If I formed a general impression, I don't know. I don't know what it was.
Did you fit in well with them? You were a university student. Oh. I mean, did you fit in well with the rest of them?
Oh, yes. I think I fitted in perfectly well. I mean, we all, mucked in together, as it were, and we all had to do the same jobs, cleaning out the latrines when our turn came and that sort of thing.
Now, what about your barrack accommodation? What was your first barrack? Was that in the new blocks?
Yes, it had been up on the top, up on the what was called the Walker Lines. Again, I'm not sure who Walker was. Walker Lines, which is now an industrial estate. Still known as Walker Lines, actually, I think.
And what was the room like? Describe the
barrack room with steel frame beds, on either side. In fact, I think they may have been double bunks, but I'm not absolutely sure about that. I think they could well have been double bunks. And it was a barrack room of some sort of 40 or 50 feet long and perhaps, 18, 20 feet wide. And with beds either along each, long wall, a doorway in the centre of one long wall, and a stove in the centre for winter heating, a stove with a chimney going straight up through the roof. That's what they generally had anyway. I can't remember that specific position of the stove.
Was there an NCO in the room too?
Yes, and he had a bunk at the end. He was a lance corporal, that his name nearly came back to me then. But he was a lance corporal and he was in charge of a lot of us.
So what would a typical day's, perhaps look at the training by means of a typical day, how would your days, this during the basic training, right. how would your day start?
Well, once we'd been told how to dress, ourselves, properly short haircuts and shaved and that sort of thing.
Well, they insisted you got that as soon as you arrived, did you?
I think we must have done. I can't remember sitting down in the barber's chair, quite honestly. But I know, that was one of the things that must have been done. I mean, we weren't allowed out of the barracks for a period, and I think it was certainly 3 weeks. We weren't, until we were fit to be seen, we weren't allowed out of the barracks. And, but the day, Reveille came quite early. I can't remember the exact time. It would have been early in the morning, and then we were up, and then we trotted along to the ablutions, whether we went individually or went by squads or something like that, but the ablutions were in a separate hut some distance away, and the toilets and that sort of thing. And then we would come back, and then we would get our mess tins, knife, forks, and spoons, parade outside for breakfast.
Now, what sort of food would you get?
How
did you react to your first experience of army food, the breakfast?
Well, I was hungry enough to be able to eat it all, there's no doubt about that. But the standard of cooking didn't compare with what it does now, the army catering corps, Marvin's job there. But it was very basic. We had a spoonful of gruel or porridge or something, and some bread and margarine, and a scraping of jam or marmalade. Because of course, food was rationed, and only rationed. Wasn't all that much more generous than.
Did you get enough to eat as young?
No, quite honestly. One was always hungry, and one had no money to buy more in the canteen, much. I didn't remember going into the canteen as a recruit.
So after breakfast, what would happen? You'd been marched down.
Well, then we'd be on perhaps drill parade or something then, you'd fall in on. You'd go back, clean your utensils, make sure your bed space is tidy. We'd probably had a parade, probably had a muster parade in the barracks room. Inspected your bed spaces.
What would they be looking for?
Well, they'd be looking to see that the blankets are properly folded and squared off, and the boots were, officially polished, and that you'd swept around your bed space and so on, and your towels were spread out neatly and that sort of thing.
Did you have men on tidying the barrack room generally? I mean, was that a job you did every day?
Well, yes.
So it was kept.
I can't remember, but I can't. I'm guessing really, but what one would have done would have taken in turns to sweep the central area or something like that. You'd have to keep your own bed space, and then in turn somebody would do the stove area or the whatever.
But this morning, this morning thing wouldn't be a full kit inspection.
No. That's just. The corporal would go around and make sure they're in the shipshape and give you a rocket if it weren't.
So after that,
then you paraded on the square, and probably the sergeant appeared then. And our sergeant was a gentleman by the name of Sergeant Dombrowski. Remember, he was a splendid man. We liked him very much.
What did you like about
him? Polish origin. Well, he had a good genial manner, and he kept discipline without harshness, and he taught us very well.
Now, so during that morning period, you'd be on one form or other of training, I presume, in a session. If we just start, you drill. Now, you've already mentioned drill. Were you learning the, because it was a light infantry barracks, were you learning at light infantry pace?
No. It wasn't light infantry. The county primary training centre was a generalised thing. And we wore a general service cap badge, compactly. The cap badge was just the Royal Coat of Arms or something like that. It was known as the General Service Badge. And we didn't belong to any particular regiment. But we did all the routine of training, much of which, the rudiments of which I'd done in the OTC, as I was saying. The foot drill, and then the arms drill, and so on. And then a bit of elementary field training, and weapon training, and bit of marching, and night exercises. I remember doing night exercises. I had a bit of fun there because, of course, I knew all the countryside around there like the back of my hand.